Good evening. Welcome back to the Proms. It's about this time each year that I suddenly begin to appreciate the vitality and versatility of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. They appear considerably more often each season than any other orchestra, 12 times this year, but it's the variety that they offer that really impresses. A stunning Verdi Requiem last Sunday, Janáček's Glagolitic Mass on the first night, less than a week later, Smetana's Mav Last. Well, tonight, a different sort of programme altogether. Six 20th century European works, a concert that places Arthur Honegger alongside Frank Bridge, features Berg setting Baudelaire in praise of wine, and presents portraits of Winter and the Sea, works by Niccolo Castiglione and Debussy. Well, the programme's been devised by conductor and composer Oliver Nusson, the BBC Symphony Orchestra's artist in association, and he starts with two works by the Swiss composer Arthur Honegger, Pastorale d'Été in just under 10 minutes' time, and first of all, Pacific 231. Now, as someone who appreciates the speed and the comfort of Britain's railways, I'm always delighted to hear this piece. I have to say, I don't stand on windy platforms collecting train data, but I suspect that Honegger was a bit of a train spotter. There's a terrific picture in the Proms programme tonight of him in mechanics overalls admiring a French Pacific class locomotive. You can see it yourself via bbc.co.uk/proms. Pacific class locos were known, thanks to the layout of their wheels, as 462s. At least that's how they were known in this country and in the Commonwealth. In France, they called them 231s, and the power, weight, strength and speed of the great steam machine inspired the work that we're about to hear. I didn't want to imitate the sound of the locomotive, said Honegger, but to convey in musical form a visual impression. The quiet turning over of the machine at rest, the sense of exertion as it starts up, the increase in speed, and then finally the emotion, the sense of passion inspired by a 300-ton train racing through the night. Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra on stage and tuned here at the Royal Albert Hall. Their leader this evening is Stephen Bryant. Honegger, one of those composers inspired after the First World War to write works inspired by the brave new world of industry and mechanisation. Mosloff's The Foundry, which we heard at the Proms last year, and Verrez's Amérique, another good example. Well, we're sort of ready to go here at the Royal Albert Hall, but I've just heard that the principal double bass has forgotten his glasses and has had to leave the stage to go and find them. So I think we're going to have a few seconds pause before he returns suitably spectacled and the music begins. I've always had a passion for locomotives, said Honegger. To me, they are living beings who I love as others love women or horses. So let's hear that passion brought to life. The double bass player is back now, waving his glasses in the air to the general entertainment of the Proms audience. And here's Stephen Bryant, leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And Oliver Nusson makes his way to the front of the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall to open tonight's prom with Honegger's Pacific 231. Oliver Nusson conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Well, you can imagine Le Tremblay thundering through the night from Paris to Nice, or the Perpignan Express drawn by one of those Pacific Class 231 locomotives. Pacific 231 by Arthur Honegger, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nussen, opening this Friday night BBC prom. Well, a vast orchestra for that first piece. No surprise, a few players to leave the stage, ready for rather more intimate Honegger in just a couple of minutes' time in Pastoral d'Été, Summer Pastoral. So while we allow the stage to clear and the orchestra to regroup, a chance to hear from Oliver Nussen. We talked earlier on this afternoon about Pacific 231, first of all, and whether or not its composer was a lover of railway engines.
There are a lot of contradictory statements by Honegger about the relationship of this piece to trains. On the one hand, he said it's a tribute to this enormous piece of machinery hurtling through the night at God knows how many kilometres an hour, which is to me what it really is. And on the other hand, he said it had nothing to do with trains, that the title was an afterthought, and that it was actually a study in acceleration while the actual tempo of the music decelerates at the same time. And it is that as well. But for me, it's a mixture, this wonderful mixture of like a kid's enthusiasm type tone poem and a piece of 1920s machine music that reminds me of these sort of posters of Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times and that sort of thing. It's very much of that world.
We're going to enter a very different world next with Honegger. Writing 3 years earlier, Pastoral d'Été, it's very different.
Almost all the pieces that I know from the early 20s, in fact, for most of those, are pretty full-on and driven pieces. And this seems to have been a rare moment of relaxation. And what I had not realised, and felicitously for this programme, actually, is that it's an alpine summer. And if you listen to it with the Alps in view, you hear little tiny bits of yodeling going on in the clarinet and things like that. What interests me about it is that he seems to have discovered for himself a specifically 20th century kind of pastoralism that I think it was very influential. I mean, for example, this piece reminds me very much in atmosphere of something like Appalachian Spring of Copland, or the gentler parts of things like Billy the Kid, and even in some respects Britain, the pastoral bits, interludes in things like The Turn of the Screw, Variations in the Turn of the Screw. And I think it's sort of a piece that's sort of been hidden in the background in some ways of our consciousness. It was very, very popular, and it also reminds me, by the way, of the music for Dr. Finlay's Casebook, but I mean, you know.
Not sure I wanted to know that immediately before we hear the piece. It's prefaced by a quote by the poet Rambo, "I embrace the summer dawn." Pastoral d'Été uses a small orchestra, single woodwind, and just one horn gently unfolds from its subtle, gentle start. Oliver Nussen returns to the rostrum to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Honegger's Pastoral d'Été. The music of a warm summer morning, one alpine August. In the country, and all seems well. Pastoral d'Ete by Arthur Honegger. What a different sound world from Pacific 231, the piece we opened with tonight. Honegger influenced by Wagner, by Debussy as well. Big fan of both composers. Composers who didn't absolutely find favour with his fellow members, the French group of composers Les Six. Honegger, though, Swiss rather than French. Well, next tonight we're going to launch the focus that runs throughout this prom season on Frank Bridge with his impression for small orchestra, There Is a Willow Grows a Slant of Brook. It's taken from Gertrude's speech in Hamlet, where she describes the death of Ophelia. And this is a work that's got its premiere here at the proms in 1927. Oliver Nussen.
I find this piece extraordinarily impressive. I'm amazed that it's not, well, it's done a lot more than it used to be done, which was never. But it has a brooding, dark quality that's also, by the way, a sort of brooding, dark, pastoral kind of quality that I find really quite unique. I want to say it's very Bergian. It reminds me very much of some of the night music, let's say, in Wozzeck and things like that. But it also looks forward to Bridge's pupil, Benjamin Britten. It also has in common a lot with the English pastoral composers who were active then, but not in terms of the actual notes. It's just the atmosphere. I suppose if there's a famous British composer that it's anything like at all, it would be Holst. And I remember looking at the score for the first time and thinking, goodness, this will be a difficult piece because you have to capture an atmosphere and it has to be together and all this blah, 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 blah. But in fact, it is so well written for the instruments and it is so well designed and so well crafted that it almost plays itself with players of this caliber.
Well, the work opens evoking the glassy stream that Gertrude describes to Hamlet and the reflections of the willow's leaves on the water. There's also a sense of doom in the air. Harp and oboe suggest the fantastic garlands that Ophelia hangs on the pendant bough. Then follows what Andrew Byrne describes in tonight's programme as a bitonal chord riven with pity. For in the vivid musical evocation of Ophelia's fall, the clarinet's precipitous descent literally plunges us into the weeping brook. A lament from solo violin, viola and cello with muted accompaniment provides Ophelia's requiem. Oliver Nussen conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra in There Is a Willow Grows a Slant a Brook by Frank Bridge. So as Gertrude recounts to Hamlet, Ophelia is no more. Her garments, heavy with their drink, pulled the poor wretch from her melodious lay to muddy death. There is A Willow Grows Aslant a Brook by Frank Bridge, composed in 3 weeks flat in 1927 after a planned American performance failed to materialise. Bridge took the work to Henry Wood, who included it in one of his Saturday night popular proms in August of that year. For Radio 3 live at the 2011 BBC Proms this Friday night, a weekend that includes a Horrible Histories prom tomorrow morning. They've been rehearsing at the hall today, and I think it's going to be great fun tomorrow. The CBBC series coming to life on stage, dressing rooms backstage packed full of costumes. It's a free prom. All the seats have gone, but you can always come along and join the arena or gallery queues, or of course listen live here on Radio 3 tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Walton Violin Concerto, played by Midori, and Prokofiev's cantata Alexander Nevsky with the CBSO tomorrow night. That's on BBC Two as well. And indeed, it's a glorious weekend for lovers of Russian music, because on Sunday, Vasily Sinaisky conducts the BBC Philharmonic in an all Rachmaninoff programme, including his choral symphony, The Bells. Well, back to tonight, and you may have noticed that the first half of this evening's programme is made up of works all written in the 1920s. We started the decade with Honegger's Pacific 231, and we finish it with Alban Berg's Der Wein, written in 1929 and sung tonight by the British soprano Claire Booth. The work came about when a Czech soprano, Ruzena Herlinger, requested a concert work from Berg. Despite the fact that he was busy with his opera Lulu and had already broken away once to write his violin concerto, he obliged, deciding to set the poetry of Baudelaire, three poems from his cycle Le Vin, which celebrates wine's ability to help us escape from the real world. Well, the poems that he chose form a sort of musical palindrome, lows to highs to lows. The spirit of wine, which opens the piece, filled with intoxicating hope and the possibility of great cheer. Then, after a few glasses have been sunk, comes the wine of lovers, fairy heaven, fevered affliction, anything is possible. And finally, the come down, the last coin at the gambling table, the strain song of the violin, the gentle hangover. Well, perhaps there is some kind of hidden message here, because Berg wrote the work at a time that he was madly and secretly in love with Hannah Fuchs-Robertine, sister of the novelist Franz Werfel and a married woman. Claire Booth is interviewed in the programme tonight. She says that the big challenge of this piece is projecting the meaning of the text to the audience. Berg, she says, sets the words at relatively low pitches for soprano, so it's hard to get the voice to speak through the orchestration. But, she says, Oliver Nussen told her, Berg specifically set it like that, wanting the sort of musical tension that comes from a soprano singing that kind of low sound. The original poems were in French, but Berg set them in German, in Stefan George's translation. That's how we're going to hear them this evening. So here is Claire Booth, dressed in a glorious silver, green and grey ensemble, Oliver Nussen behind her, join the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Alban Berg's Der Wein.
Niemals undankbar und schlecht.
Der Wein by Alban Berg, sung by Claire Booth, Oliver Nussen conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Wine that gives hope, love, the strength of youth and pride, a pauper's legacy that makes us heroes and akin to the gods. Wine of the solitary, preceded by the wine of the lovers, as Berg wrote to his secret lover, Hannah Fuchs-Robertine. What follows can only be the song of the wine of the solitary one, for I am and that I remain. Set started with the spirit of wine. Claire Booth returns to the platform. She has a long history of working with Oliver Nussen. Recently performed Alban Berg's Wozzeck Fragments with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. This autumn she heads to Scottish Opera to sing her first Rosina in Rossini's Barber of Seville. Der Wein, written while Berg was writing his opera Lulu, and that sound world of Lulu very much on display, as if Berg wanted to try out his ideas and share them early with the public, saxophone and very influential jazz elements, for example, that you heard in that piece. Well, it's 25 past eight. We reach the interval of tonight's prom with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Oliver Nussen will return in 20 minutes to lead the performance of two very different, evocative, descriptive works. Inverno in Ver, 11 musical poems by Niccolo Castiglioni, getting its prom's premiere. His winter piece with portraits of a frozen lake and hoarfrost. Then we take to the ocean with waves and wind in Debussy's La Mer. Well, on Radio 3, we're going to take to the waters right now with a nautical tale from Catherine Mansfield. Indira Varma reads Mansfield's classic 1921 story, The Voyage, the tale of a young girl's journey into an unknown future on board an overnight ferry in the Straits of New Zealand.
The Picton boat was due to leave at 11:30. It was a beautiful night. Mild, starry. Only when they got out of the cab and started to walk down the old wharf that jutted out into the harbour, a faint wind blowing off the water ruffled under Fenella's hat, and she put up her hand to keep it on. It was dark on the old wharf, very dark. The wool sheds, the cattle trucks, the little squat railway engine all seemed carved out of solid darkness. Here and there, on a rounded woodpile that was like the stalk of a huge black mushroom, there hung a lantern, but it seemed afraid to unfurl its timid, quivering light in all that blackness. It burned softly, as if for itself. Fenella's father pushed on with quick, nervous strides. Beside him, her grandma bustled along in her crackling black ulster. They went so fast that she had now and again to give an undignified little skip to keep up with them. As well as her luggage strapped into a neat sausage, Fenella carried, clasped to her, her grandma's umbrella. And the handle, which was a swan's head, kept giving her shoulder a sharp little peck, as if it too wanted her to hurry. Men, their caps pulled down, their collars turned up, swung by. A few women, all muffled, scurried along. And one tiny boy, only his little black arms and legs showing out of a white woolly shawl, was jerked along angrily between his father and mother. He looked like a baby fly that had fallen into the cream. Then suddenly, so suddenly that Fenella and her grandma both leapt, there sounded from behind the largest wool shed that had a trail of smoke hanging over it, "Ooh!" First whistle, said her father briefly, and at that moment they came in sight of the boat. Lying beside the dark wharf, all strung, all beaded with round golden lights, the Picton boat looked as if she were more ready to sail among stars than out into the cold sea. People pressed along the gangway. First went her grandma, then her father, then Fenella. There was a high step down onto the deck, and an old sailor in a jersey standing by gave her his dry, hard hand. They were there, and standing under a little iron stairway that led to the upper deck, they began to say goodbye.
There, Mother, there's your luggage,
said Fenella's father, giving Grandma another strapped-up sausage. Thank you, Frank.
And you've got your cabin ticket safe?
Yes, dear.
And your other tickets?
Grandma felt for them inside her glove and showed him the tips.
That's right.
He sounded stern, but Fenella, eagerly watching him, saw that he looked tired and sad. The second whistle blared just above their heads, and a voice like a cry shouted, "Any more for the gangway?"
"You'll give my love to Father,"
Fenella saw her father's lips say. And her grandma, very agitated, answered, "Of course I will, dear. Go now. You'll be left. Go now, Frank. Go now."
"It's all right, Mother. I've got another 3 minutes."
To her surprise, Fenella saw her father take off his hat. He clasped Grandma in his arms and pressed her to him.
"God bless you, Mother."
And Grandma put her hand, with the black thread glove that was worn through on her ring finger, against his cheek, and she sobbed, "God bless you, my own brave son." This was so awful that Fenella quickly turned her back on them, swallowed once, twice, and frowned terribly at a little green star on a masthead. But she had to turn round again. Her father was going.
"Goodbye, Fenella. Be a good girl."
His cold, wet moustache brushed her cheek. But Fenella caught hold of the lapels of his coat.
"How long am I going to stay?"
she whispered anxiously. He wouldn't look at her. He shook her off gently and gently said,
"We'll see about that. Here, where's your hand?"
He pressed something into her palm.
"Here's a shilling in case you should need it."
"A shilling?"
She must be going away forever.
"Father!"
cried Fenella. But he was gone. He was the last off the ship. The sailors put their shoulders to the gangway. A huge coil of dark rope went flying through the air and fell thump on the wharf. A bell rang, a whistle shrilled. Silently, the dark wharf began to slip, to slide, to edge away from them. Now there was a rush of water between. Fenella strained to see with all her might. Was that father turning round? Or waving? Or standing alone? The strip of water grew broader, darker. Now the boat began to swing round steady, pointing out to sea. It was no good looking any longer. The freshening wind tugged at Fenella's skirts. She went back to her grandma. To her relief, Grandma seemed no longer sad. She had put the two sausages of luggage, one on top of the other, and she was sitting on them, her hands folded, her head a little on one side. There was an intent, bright look on her face. Then Fenella saw that her lips were moving and guessed that she was praying. But the old woman gave her a bright nod, as if to say the prayer was nearly over. She unclasped her hands, sighed, clasped them again, bent forward, and at last gave herself a soft shake. "And now, child," she said, fingering the bow of her bonnet strings, "I think we ought to see about our cabins. Keep close to me, and mind you don't slip."
"Yes, Grandma."
"And be careful the umbrellas aren't caught in the stair rail. I saw a beautiful umbrella broken in half like that on my way over."
"Yes, Grandma."
Dark figures of men lounged against the rails. In the glow of their pipes, a nose shone out, or the peak of a cap, or a pair of surprised-looking eyebrows. Fenella glanced up. High in the air, a little figure, his hands thrust in his short jacket pockets, stood staring out to sea. The ship rocked ever so little, and she thought the stars rocked too. And now a pale steward in a linen coat, holding a tray high in the palm of his hand, stepped out of a lighted doorway and skimmed past them. They went through that doorway, carefully over the high brass-bound step, and then down such a terribly steep flight of stairs that Grandma had to put both feet on each step. And Fenella clutched the clammy brass rail and forgot all about the swan-necked umbrella. At the bottom, Grandma stopped. Fenella was rather afraid she was going to pray again, but no, it was only to get out the cabin tickets. They were in the saloon. It was glaring bright and stifling. The air smelled of paint and burnt chop bones and India rubber. Fenella wished her grandma would go on, but the old woman was not to be hurried. An immense basket of ham sandwiches caught her eye. She went up to them and touched the top one delicately with her finger. "How much are the sandwiches?" she asked.
"Tuppence," bawled a rude steward, slamming down a knife and fork.
Grandma could hardly believe it.
"2 pence each?" she asked.
"That's right," said the steward, and he winked at his companion.
Grandma made a small, astonished face. Then she whispered primly to Fenella,
"What wickedness!"
And they sailed out at the further door and along a passage that had cabins on either side. Such a very nice stewardess came to meet them. She seemed to know Grandma well.
"Well, Mrs. Crane," said she, unlocking their washstand, "we've got you back again. It's not often you give yourself a cabin."
"No," said Grandma, "but this time my dear son's thoughtfulness."
"I hope," began the stewardess. Then she turned round and took a long, mournful look at Grandma's blackness and at Fenella's black coat and skirt, black blouse and hat with a crepe rose. Grandma nodded.
"It was God's will," said she.
The stewardess shut her lips, and taking a deep breath, she seemed to expand.
"What I always say is," she said, as though it were her own discovery, "sooner or later each of us has to go, and that's a certainty." She paused.
"Now, can I bring you anything, Mrs. Crane? A cup of tea? I know it's no good offering you a little something to keep the cold out."
Grandma shook her head.
"Nothing, thank you. We've got a few wine biscuits, and Fenella has a very nice banana."
"Then I'll give you a look later on," said the stewardess.
And she went out, shutting the door.
What a very small cabin it was. It was like being shut up in a box with Grandma.
The dark round eye above the washstand gleamed at them dully. Fenella stood against the door, still clasping her luggage and the umbrella.
Were they going to get undressed in here?
Already her grandma had taken off her bonnet, and rolling up the strings, she fixed each with a pin to the lining before she hung the bonnet up. Her white hair shone like silk. The little bun at the back was covered with a black net. Fenella hardly ever saw her grandma with her head uncovered. She looked strange.
"I shall put on the woolen fascinator your dear mother crocheted for me," said Grandma.
And unstrapping the sausage, she took it out and wound it round her head. The fringe of grey bobbles danced at her eyebrows as she smiled tenderly and mournfully at Fenella. Then she undid her bodice, and something under that, and something else underneath that. Then there seemed a short, sharp tussle, and Grandma flushed faintly. She had undone her stays. She breathed a sigh of relief, and sitting on the plush couch, she slowly and carefully pulled off her elastic-sided boots and stood them side by side. By the time Fenella had taken off her coat and skirt and put on her flannel dressing gown, Grandma was quite ready.
"Must I take off my boots, Grandma? They're lace."
Grandma gave them a moment's deep consideration.
"You'd feel a great deal more comfortable if you did, child," said she. She kissed Fenella. "Don't forget to say your prayers. Our dear Lord is with us when we are at sea, even more than when we are on dry land."
"And because I am an experienced traveller," said Grandma briskly, "I shall take the upper berth."
"But, Grandma, however will you get up there?"
3 little spider-like steps were all Fenella saw. The old woman gave a small silent laugh before she mounted them nimbly, and she peered over the high bunk at the astonished Fenella.
"You didn't think your grandma could do that, did you?"
said she. And as she sank back, Fenella heard her light laugh again.
How hard it was to turn down those stiff sheets. You simply had to tear your way in. If everything had been different, Fenella might have got the giggles. At last she was inside, and while she lay there panting, there sounded from above a long, soft whispering, as though someone was gently, gently rustling among tissue paper to find something. It was Grandma saying her prayers. A long time passed. Then the stewardess came in. She trod softly and leaned her hand on Grandma's bunk. It's a fine night, but we're rather empty. We may pitch a little. And indeed, at that moment, the Picton boat rose and rose and hung in the air just long enough to give a shiver before she swung down again, and there was the sound of heavy water slapping against her sides. Fenella remembered she had left the swan-necked umbrella standing up on the little couch. If it fell over, would it break? But Grandma remembered too, at the same time. I wonder if you'd mind, stewardess, laying down my umbrella, she whispered. Not at all, Mrs. Crane. And the stewardess, coming back to Grandma, breathed, your little granddaughter's in such a beautiful sleep. God be praised for that, said Grandma. Poor little motherless mite, said the stewardess. And Grandma was still telling the stewardess all about what happened when Fenella fell asleep. But she hadn't been asleep long enough to dream before she woke up again to see something waving in the air above her head. What could it be? It was a small grey foot. Now another joined it. They seemed to be feeling about for something. There came a sigh.
I'm awake, Grandma, said Fenella.
Oh dear, am I near the ladder? I thought it was this end.
No, Grandma, it's the other. I'll put your foot on it. Are we there?
In the harbour, said Grandma. We must get up, child. You'd better have a biscuit to steady yourself before you move.
But Fenella had hopped out of her bunk. The lamp was still burning, but night was over and it was cold. Peering through that round eye, she could see far off some rocks. Now they were scattered over with foam. Now a gull flipped by.
It's land, Grandma, said Fenella wonderingly,
as though they had been at sea for weeks together. She hugged herself. She stood on one leg and rubbed it with the toes of the other foot. She was trembling. Oh, it had all been so sad lately. Was it going to change? But all her grandma said was, make haste, child. I should leave your nice banana for the stewardess, as you haven't eaten it. And Fenella put on her black clothes again, and they went up on deck. But if it had been cold in the cabin, on deck it was like ice. The sun was not up yet, but the stars were dim, and the cold, pale sky was the same colour as the cold, pale sea. On the land, a white mist rose and fell. Even the shapes of the umbrella ferns showed, and those strange silvery withered trees that are like skeletons. Now they could see the landing stage and some little houses, pale too, clustered together like shells on the lid of a box. And now the landing stage came out to meet them. Slowly it swam towards the Picton boat, and a man holding a coil of rope and a cart with a small drooping horse and another man sitting on the step came too.
It's Mr. Penready, Fenella, come for us, said Grandma.
She sounded pleased. Her white, waxen cheeks were blue with cold, her chin trembled, and she had to keep wiping her eyes and her little pink nose.
You've got my... Yes, Grandma.
Fenella showed it to her. The rope came flying through the air, and smack, it fell onto the deck. Again, Fenella followed her grandma onto the wharf, and a moment later they were bowling away. The hooves of the little horse drummed over the wooden piles, then sank softly into the sandy road. Not a soul was to be seen. The mist rose and fell, and the sea still sounded asleep as slowly it turned on the beach.
"I seen Mr. Crane yesterday," said Mr. Penready. "He looked himself then. Missus knocked him up a batch of scones last week."
And now the little horse pulled up before one of the shell-like houses. They got down. Fenella put her hand on the gate, and the big trembling dewdrops soaked through her glove tips. Up a little path of round white pebbles they went, with drenched sleeping flowers on either side. Grandma's delicate white picotees were so heavy with dew that they were fallen, but their sweet smell was part of the cold morning. They mounted the steps onto the veranda.
"Tut, tut, your grandpa," said Grandma.
She turned the handle. Not a sound.
"Walter?"
And immediately a deep voice that sounded half stifled called back,
"Is that you, Mary?"
"Wait, dear," said Grandma. "Go in there." She pushed Fenella gently into a small, dusky sitting room. On the table, a white cat that had been folded up like a camel rose, stretched itself, yawned, and then sprang onto the tips of its toes. Fenella buried one cold little hand in the white, warm fur and smiled timidly while she stroked and listened to Grandma's gentle voice and the rolling tones of Grandpa. A door creaked. "Come in, dear," the old woman beckoned. Fenella followed. There, lying to one side on an immense bed, lay Grandpa. Just his head with a white tuft and his rosy face and long silver beard showed over the quilt. He was like a very old, wide-awake bird.
"Well, my girl," said Grandpa, "give us a kiss."
Fenella kissed him.
"Oh, her little nose is as cold as a button. What's that she's holding? Her grandma's umbrella?"
Fenella smiled again and crooked the swan neck over the bed rail. Above the bed there was a big text in a deep black frame. "Lost. One golden hour. Set with 60 diamond minutes. No reward is offered, for it is gone forever."
"Your grandma painted that," said Grandpa.
And he ruffled his white tuft and looked at Fenella so merrily, she almost thought he winked at her.
Indira Varma was reading The Voyage by Catherine Mansfield. It was abridged and produced by Justin Willett. And this is Petroc Trelawney welcoming you back live to the Royal Albert Hall for this Friday night prom, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nusson. After a first half of works from the 1920s, we move forward and back in the second half of the concert. Later, Debussy's La Mer, finished in 1905. First a work from the 1970s, getting its first ever proms performance, Inverno in Verre, by the Italian composer Niccolò Castiglioni. 11 short glimpses into a winter landscape. Inverno, meaning winter in Italian. The Inver, I-N-V-E-R, perhaps a play on in veritas, in truth. Earlier I talked with Oliver Nusson about this piece and its Alpine influences.
Castiglioni lived a good part of his later life in the town of Bressanone, or Brixen, in the Italian Alps. And his music is absolutely shot through with images of winter and cold and the cool air. To me, it sounds like a very eccentric Vivaldi 250 years on, writing a Four Seasons, and as the centuries have gone past, it's gone up an octave every century. So it's almost all in the high registers of the instrument, which makes it very difficult a lot of the time, and it's full of images of the nice things about the cold.
It's got a very interesting orchestration, hasn't it? I mean, he makes huge use of the percussion section, for example.
Well, the percussion section is, with one exception, entirely made out of metal instruments. So you've got bells, you've got a glockenspiel, you've got a vibraphone, you've got a triangle, and you've got various types of cymbals, and what he calls Chinese metal wind chimes. Goodness knows what those are. We've put various things together to make something sounding convincing. And everything is permeated with this sort of metallic aura. These blend beautifully with the piano and the celesta and the harp, which play almost incessantly also, and also with the high winds.
Oliver Nelson talking to me earlier on. Castiglione once classed Inverno in Ver as being amongst his limpid works, and said, "I was trying to depict in music ice, the sparkling of the frost and frozen water, aspects of the winter landscape." Castiglione was born in Milan in 1932. He studied piano at the Conservatoire with Friedrich Gulder. He was a concert pianist for much of his life, alongside his work as a composer. Influences very eclectic, including Mahler, Debussy, Webern, Boulez and Cage. Became an increasingly isolated figure on the contemporary Italian music scene before his death in 1996, though his posthumous reputation is steadily increasing. Oliver Nelson, one of his champions. Well, a few last players from the BBC Symphony Orchestra drifting onto the stage, seemingly in no particular hurry, but I suppose it is a Friday night. Never anything predictable or expected when Oliver Nusson is in charge. He is colloquially known as Ollie, works regularly with this orchestra, very much the big man of music in many senses. He's built up a firm and strong relationship with the symphony orchestra players. He is artist in association, and several of his own works have been written for the BBC Symphony Orchestra to play. Well, 8 of the 11 movements of Inverno in Ver have names. Flowers of Ice, The Stream, Winter Dance, Hoar Frost, The Frozen Lake, Silence, An Old Adagio, and finally, Noise Does No Good, The Food Makes No Noise. So here is Oliver Nelson to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Inverno in Ver by Niccolò Castiglione. The first performance at the proms of Inverno in Ver by Niccolo Castiglioni. 11 musical poems, a description of an alpine winter. Oliver Nussen conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Bringing to their feet just a few seconds ago, Elizabeth Burley, the pianist, Stephen Betteridge, Celeste, Louise Martin and Manon Morris playing harps, and the percussion section led this evening by Alex Neal. Well, it's a warm night here in the Royal Albert Hall, but there seemed to be a terrific chill during that as we imagined the hoar frost and the snow and the icicles. What a showcase for the skill and talent of the BBC Symphony Orchestra and their extraordinary ability to embrace works like this. Oliver Nussen playing from a huge score that he sort of unfolded out in front of him. Great 3 feet long sections of music. In fact, he was playing from a miniature score this evening, the full score of the work. The pages are more than 4 foot long. No space for those on the rostrum tonight here at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, to finish tonight's prom, a work that one former BBC Symphony Orchestra chief conductor described as inaugurating a new and extremely personal type of sonorous universe, as new in colour as in mobility. That was Pierre Boulez on Debussy's La Mer, the archetype of music as Impressionism. Though, as Debussy himself wrote, his discipline had the potential to go further than the work of French visual artists. Music has this over painting. It can bring together all manner of variations of colour and light as they continually change in time. Debussy started his trio of symphonic sketches in Burgundy, far from the oceans. That wasn't a problem. As he said, I have an endless store of memories of the sea, and to my mind, they're worth more than the reality, whose beauty weighs down thought too heavily. He did at least complete the orchestration of the piece with a sea view, staying at the Grand Hotel at Eastbourne in 1905. Well, I've been talking to Oliver Nussen about the piece, and we began by discussing just what sort of sea it is that Debussy was painting.
I once went for a walk with Henri Dutilleux on the seafront at Aldborough, actually, and he said, out of the blue, apropos of nothing, you know, it's this kind of a seascape that La Mer is about. Usually people think it's the, you know, the Mediterranean or something, but he said it's this sort of seascape. And sort of, the Normandy kind of coast. And I thought that was a very astute perception, because it's not a warm piece, La Mer. It's got moments of enormous warmth in it, but it's an uncomfortable sea. I find various other things, bits of observation, which I... For example, in both the second movement, the Game of the Waves, and in the last movement, the way the trumpets are used are almost like melodic bosun's whistles. They play the same phrase over and over again, very widely separated, and it's almost like signals that remain static.
And it comes rather well at the end of a program where we've seen all sorts of different uses of the orchestra, different forms of orchestration, and here's Debussy doing what I think was quite radical when he wrote it in terms of creating each instrument almost as a solo character and then pulling it together.
Yes. Well, again, there's this business that Debussy does not so much mix as superimpose. Ravel mixes and everything sounds beautifully blended, and Debussy superimposes things so that they sound interesting together, but they're usually doing different things. I'm rather happy with it in this programme, because virtually everything in this programme has to do with a different kind of moisture. You've got steam for Pacific 231, you've got the brook for the in the Frank Bridge, you've got wine, you've got ice, and you've got the sea. What more could you want?
Oliver Nussen talking to me earlier on this afternoon. He really is such an enthusiast about putting programmes together, assembling them with great care and love, and working through them gently with the orchestra, who regard him with enormous fondness as both a conductor and a composer. The BBC Symphony Orchestra have over the years given so many of his works their first outings. Well, there's still a bit of shuffling going on the stage right now as the full orchestra gets into position. We've got a couple of microphones to move as well, so that we make sure you get the best picture of the sound on Radio 3. If you enjoyed the piece by Castiglione, by the way, you might feel that your appreciation of it would benefit further by a second listen. I listened to it myself this afternoon at rehearsal and found it opened up even further just then, hearing it for a second time. This prom gets a repeat on Monday afternoon on BBC Radio 3, so if you want to enjoy the Castiglione, or indeed if you missed the bridge and the Honegger that Oliver Nussen made reference to earlier on, Monday afternoon on Radio 3, or of course you can listen to the whole prom at your leisure for the next 7 days at bbc.co.uk/radio3, and follow the links to the iPlayer. Well, as I say, started in the middle of France, La Mer, but finished at the Grand Hotel in Eastbourne. There's a wonderful picture in tonight's prom programme of Debussy clutching a camera outside the Grand Hotel. Quite sure what he's photographing. Perhaps he's photographing the sea. Who knows? I was looking at their website, actually, yesterday, and they're very proud of the fact that Debussy finished La Mer. They're also proud of the fact that the BBC used to broadcast a light music dance band show once a week for many a decade from the Grand Hotel in Eastbourne. Well, the three movements of La Mer, from dawn to midday on the sea, games of waves, and then dialogue of the wind and sea. Oliver Nussen returns to the platform for the final time this evening to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in La Mer by Debussy.
Thank you.
And so a concert that began with a mighty railway locomotive ends with something of much greater power, the dialogue of the wind and the sea at the conclusion of Debussy's La Mer. There's three symphonic sketches, starting with From Dawn to Midday on the Sea, and then in the middle, Games of the Waves. Oliver Nussen conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra this Friday night here at the Royal Albert Hall. A great work of symphony and seascape indivisibly tied together, and a work that offers a huge range of interpretive possibilities, which perhaps explains why since 1989 La Mer has only been absent from the Proms during two seasons. The woodwind, and now the brass players of the BBC Symphony Orchestra on their feet. Now harp and celeste. Percussion section joined by the strings. Leader Stephen Bryant shaking Oliver Nussen's hand. Well, tomorrow night at the Proms, Horrible Histories, all those costumes being put to use. That's at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. Free prom, the seats have gone, but do join the queue for the arena and the gallery or listen live on Radio 3. And then tomorrow night it's the CBSO and Andres Nelson's live on Radio 3 at 7:30, or you can catch it a little later at 9 o'clock on BBC 2. For now, though, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra on stage still, conductor Oliver Nussen, it's time to bid you very good night for now from the Royal Albert Hall. Back to Jill Anderson at Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much. That was Petroc Trelawney. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock on Radio 3. Or, of course, you can listen anytime you like for the next 7 days on the Radio 3 website.
Performers and music lovers from across the globe come together for an inspirational weekend of music at WOMAD. Exclusive coverage on BBC Radio 3 of the UK's biggest festival of world music. WOMAD 2011. 8 hours of live world music performances from Wiltshire. Coming to BBC Radio 3 this weekend.
And we start that 8 hours tonight at 11 o'clock, when Marianne Kennedy, Lopa Kattari, Lucy Duran and Andrew McGregor introduce our broadcast live from the festival site in Charlton Park in Wiltshire. We'll be hearing Alpha Blondie perform at the open air stage and Fies Ali Fies. Also featured are Abigail Washbourne and The Village from America and the Romanian gypsy band Mahala Rai Banda. That's all at 11 o'clock. Before that, in the essay, the countertenor Michael Chance will be discussing the trials and rewards of life as a long-distance opera singer. And in about 9 minutes' time at 10 o'clock, Judith Kampfner meets the writer John Berger in Paris to discuss his recent decision to donate his archive to the British Library. Well, to take us up to John Berger in Paris, here's some Debussy piano music, played by Jean Ephlam Bavouzet, who played Bartok's first piano concerto at the Prom on Tuesday evening. This is the Nocturne, published in 1892.
Thank you.
Jean F. Lambavouzet played Debussy's Nocturne. Now, a mazurka from 1890. Debussy's Mazurka was played by Jean F. Lambavouzet. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 10 o'clock and we've another chance to hear Harvesting the Archive, the story of how boxes of the papers of writer John Berger moved from a stable in the Alps to the British Library, and how a young curator believes that the acquisition and cataloguing of archives can involve a wide public. Judith Kampfner explores the library's novel approach to archive gathering and John Berger's evolving thoughts about the process.
When in the summer of 2009 John Berger offered his archive to the British Library, he joined an ever-growing list of living artistic movers and shakers who've chosen to hand over their archives to a public institution. I talked to John on one of his visits to Paris and asked him how he would define his donation and what archives meant to him. And he chose not to answer the question directly. Instead, he offered to read something. At first, I was disappointed that I was getting an indirect answer, but then it seemed entirely appropriate for an author who often writes very poetically about the experiences of people going about their daily lives that he should choose to read the passage that he then selected.
It's something that I wrote very recently that I actually finished writing 2 days ago. And it took about 2.5 years. And it's also a homage to libraries. What I like about libraries is the activities that is going on in them. Because it's about reading, because it's about what happens and the kind of effect that words written on sheets of paper have on people's lives. And that seemed to me to be a subject perhaps not so far away from the subject of archives.
John chose to record two pages from his recent unpublished book, Good to Know You, which I then shared with composer Gavin Bryars, with whom Berger has collaborated in the past. Gavin suggested underscoring the reading with a composition of his called Number One from Tre Laude Dolci.
The librarian consulted a computer. We both waited. The wait was friendly, full of the special time which wanders in municipal libraries, like a solitary walker between trees in a wood. She lifts her head and says, "We have two copies, and I'm afraid they are both out. You want to reserve one?" "I'll come back another day." She nods and turns to attend to an elderly woman, younger than me, who is holding three books in one hand. People hold books in a special way, like they hold nothing else. With e-books, this gesture might one day disappear. And they hold them not like inanimate things, but rather like ones that have gone to sleep. Children often carry toys in the same way. The public library is in a Paris suburb, which has a population of around 60,000. About 4,000 people are inscribed in the library and have tickets for borrowing books, four books at a time. Others come to the library to read the papers and journals or to consult the reference shelves. If one takes account of the number of babies and really young kids in this suburb, all this probably means that about one person in 10 in the suburb has a ticket and sometimes takes home books to read. And I wonder who is reading The Brothers Karamazov here in this suburb today. Do the two of them, because there are two, do the two of them know each other? Unlikely. Are they both reading the book for the first time? Or has one of them read it and, like myself, wants to reread it? Then I find myself asking an odd question. If either of those readers and myself passed one another, or in the suburban market on Sunday, coming out of the metro station, on a pedestrian crossing, buying bread in the baker's, might we perhaps exchange glances that we would both find puzzling? Might we, without recognizing it, recognize one another? When we are impressed, moved, shifted by a story, it engenders something that becomes or may become an essential part of us. And this part, whether it be small or extensive, is, as it were, the story's descendant or offspring. What I'm trying to define is more idiosyncratic and personal than a mere cultural inheritance, because it's as if the bloodstream of the red story joins the bloodstream of one's life story. In some way, it contributes to our becoming what we become and will continue to become. Without any of the complications and conflicts of family ties, these stories, the stories that we have read, shape us and are coincidental as distinct from biological ancestors. Somebody in this Paris suburb, perhaps sitting tonight in a chair and reading The Brothers Karamazov, may already, in this sense, be a distant, distant, distant cousin.
I'm Jamie Andrews. I'm head of modern literary manuscripts at the British Library in London.
What counts as modern?
Modern is an interesting one. It's slightly older than you might think. The section's responsibilities in theory are essentially post-medieval, so they run from 1600 onwards, which is obviously an incredible amount of material to be responsible for and to deal with, and that dates back really to the old museum ethos. The British Library used to be part of the museum and is only really an independent institution since 1972. It's clearly changed now, and a lot of our focus is actually on the contemporary, very much 20th and even 21st century.
You're not the stereotype of what one would imagine as somebody working behind the scenes at the British Library.
Yeah, I mean, there is a... My predecessor was very much in the corduroy jacket mould, and he actually left his corduroy jacket here when he moved on, so I've taken on the symbolic mantle of the corduroy jacket, even if I don't actually wear it. Things have very much changed in the last 10 years, and the impetus for that change was moving buildings from a building that was seeped in history in the best possible sense, but inevitably encouraged a certain looking back towards a new, fresh building where everything's starting anew. And there was a sense, I think, certainly in the British Museum days, when you look back at the notes and the memos for this, that curators and institutionally, people were afraid to approach these dreadful, frightful things called living writers. What do you say to them? How do you engage with them? And it was much easier just waiting until these things came to the museum naturally through bequests. But gradually that changed and people realised that, no, you had to go out and talk to writers, even talk to them before they started thinking about archives, because it's only a certain stage in a writer's life that he or she begins to think of what up until now has been a hitherto higgledy-piggledy collection of papers stored somewhere in the attic or whatever, that somehow this coalesces in front of their eyes into an archive that may have needs for posterity. And it's up to us now, I think, to talk to writers before they get to that point to make them aware that what they're keeping has value. We have to be quite interventionist, I think, in our approach to archiving.
You approached him, didn't you? So one of the reasons why the archive is here is because of you.
I certainly don't think, imagine I'm the only person who could ever have worked at a library who would have recognised the value of John Berger's work in this idea of the manuscript hunter. In a lot of the publicity that comes out of American institutions, it's all about bagging the prey and very much seen from one very particular perspective, whereas I like to think that we actually act as honest brokers in determining what probably is for the best, both for the writer but also for the users.
I mean, I don't remember whether he wrote to me with a suggestion or I wrote to him with a suggestion. I really don't remember.
I mean, I'm not a Berger scholar, and I came about it all the wrong way in that I discovered his work from the 90s and worked backwards. Whereas I imagine people who have grown up with him would have things like G or ways of seeing as absolute reference points from which they started. I suppose the first thing I can remember reading, or it may not have been, was To the Wedding, which is a relatively recent work, but also one of his better known works, I guess. It's elegantly, beautifully sad work, but still, as with him, it's got this twinkle to it, this irrepressible sense of life and humanity, even amidst the sadness of the way the story works out.
A huge feeling of sensuous life.
Absolutely. I love his descriptions of dancing. I mean, not necessarily in that, but in all the short stories, the life that he manages to exude when describing dancing, that kind of Dionysian release, is incredibly attractive in an absolutely life-giving way. I mean, this job, there has to be a certain neutrality in that my job isn't to collect writers I like, because that would give a very skewed view. And I think that has happened in the past. Certainly, if you look at some of our historic collections, you can ascertain the types of people who were doing the collecting who came from a very particular and perhaps slightly limited background. So, yeah, on the one hand, it's up to me to look at the British literary scene and think who is important and significant and who might be. But inevitably, you bring your own enthusiasms to it, and Berger was one who I guess I admire, as I kind of grew up admiring a lot of these more continental French-style engaged intellectuals who manifested their commitment across a variety of forms, who'd be writing plays one day and novels the next and whatever. And I saw a bit of that in Berger, just in the sheer variety of his work. So it was, I guess, a happy coincidence in that he was one of the people who would be on my mind when I got the job and came to thinking about writers that we needed to be approaching.
4 years after Jamie Andrews first contacted Berger, he set off on a journey which would culminate in the acquisition of the archive. For over 40 years, John Berger has lived in a remote farm high in the French Alps. And the deal struck between the 82-year-old author, artist and critic and the young curator was that John would make the donation if Jamie came to help him pack it up. And, an important caveat, Jamie would have to help the villagers bring in the harvest. This wasn't an odd request. In fact, I came across several friends and acolytes who said that doing a spot of manual labour is an important part of any visit to John. Keen to share the adventure and the role of the British Library with the public, Jamie Andrews used new Audio Boo software so that with one click he could upload short commentaries and photos to the library's Facebook and Twitter feeds.
I'm Jamie Andrews from the British Library. I work at the library with modern literary manuscripts, and this is the first of my Audio Boo updates as I journey down to the Alps on the Franco-Swiss border to see the writer and critic and essayist John Berger. So at the moment we've just pulled out of Paris's Gare de Lyon on board one of France's rather wonderful TGVs. We arrived here late last night, having got a variety of trains into Annemasse, which is down at the bottom of the valley, and seems to be the main transport connection point around here. And the bad news, as far as the prospective haymaking is concerned, is that it was fairly soaking last night. The rain started up gently, and then by about midnight it was raining pretty heavily, which, according to those in the know, which is certainly not me, it's likely to put pay to any prospective haymaking for a couple of days. So, as far as the farming is concerned, I'm not quite sure how that will go. Anyway, we saw John and Beverly last night for a little postprandial digestif, the local noël, which I'd read about, of course, in the trilogy, the Into Their Labours trilogy, without ever quite being sure what it was. And it's, I mean, the translation of noël is something like moonshine. It's illegal home-produced liquor. So we saw John and Beverly, and they were very welcoming. And we're going to go back now to begin to sort through the archive, and I'll try and send some pictures when we get there.
The very story of your journey was so delightful and engaging as a story in itself. Helping with the harvest, riding with this eminent author on his motorbike, and that would bring in a whole load of people who aren't interested in literary archives.
Oh, absolutely, and I think that's important. I mean, I'm constantly asking myself who pays for what we do, and it's not just some hardcore researchers, it's the public, because we're a public institution, and obviously we seek matching funding from a variety of partners, but fundamentally we're a public institution, which means that we have to think about the public at large. And I'm really keen that we provide some kind of value for people who will never actually come to the reading room and write a thesis on John Berger, because you don't want everyone doing that by any means, and not everyone will want to. And just looking out of the window now, it seems that the clouds are dispersing and the sun's shining through, which gives me hope that there might just be some haymaking today. It'd be good for me to experience. Working at the library is all about developing new skills, and haymaking is certainly a skill I'd like to add to the old CV. But also it's going to be important for the villagers, because this is prime haymaking time. The photo which is going to accompany this boo is of the view from John and Beverly's garden, with a couple of the local cows looking on with some interest at the archive. Just back from a slightly longer walk than intended. The last Audio Boo update, I tried to send it from the top of the hill at Saumon, which is just under 5,000 feet, I think, but the reception didn't seem to be strong enough. It just it wasn't uploading. So after I got back from that 20k yomp, I guess, John came and picked me up on his motorbike, which was which is pretty cool, actually. The first time I'd ever been in a motorbike, and if it has to be a first time in a motorbike, then being in the back of John Berger's motorbike seems a pretty good way to go. Wasn't quite sure how that might affect any kind of insurance cover that the British Library offers its employees to be hairing around Swiss Alpine roads on the back of 82-year-old writer's motorbike, but anyway, it turned out okay. Felt kind of funny, of course, if you're in the back of a motorbike going at some speed round corners, you have to grip on fairly tightly, and yet that felt somehow not respectful of John, one of the most important living British writers. It didn't feel quite right, kind of having to cling on to him for dear life, but the self-preservation instinct kicked in pretty quickly, and that's what I did. I'll do a fuller update tomorrow. But
what can I say? I mean, the pleasure of meeting him, I mean, I like him, and we got on very well. He's very, very good company. Very thoughtful person, very knowledgeable. So that was a pleasure.
Okay, another update. We're just starting to work through all the boxes. We've seen about 50 or 60 boxes so far in the stable next to the house, most of which are in fairly good condition. They've been excellently labelled, but probably time to be moving them to the library, as some of them are starting to look slightly damp, which is unsurprising given the conditions here in winter.
I mean, they were getting dusty, even though they were in boxes and so on, and it was a question of putting them somewhere where they would be safe for those who wanted, if they wanted to look at them. To give them away was, in fact, I don't know how to put it exactly. I mean, in a way, it was a relief. And then, okay, I mean, I know that, you know, you can make money out of that because people sell their archives. And, well, that really didn't interest me. I think because I don't like putting prices, money values on things of the heart or things of concerning passion or even really things concerning the imagination. But I somewhere am perhaps deeply unmercantile, and it is market forces, as they are now called, who are at the moment ruining both materially and socially and politically the planet. Therefore, if one can take decisions and do things which have nothing to do with the values behind those market forces, so much the better.
We've just been working through a box to do with film correspondence with some incredible names in there, letters from people like Sally Potter and Ken Loach, and some really exciting, apparently unrealised projects, which I think the researchers will be very interested in, including an aborted collaboration with Tom Waits. And I'm going to attach a few photos. We've been bringing them out to the garden, to a table in the garden, in a wheelbarrow, which is not the transport method of choice for archives, but it certainly seems to do the job here.
One of the most important people who saw John Berger's archive in its original habitat is the writer Jeff Dyer. His overview of Berger's work is titled Ways of Telling, a reference to Berger's book Ways of Seeing and the associated TV series, which Dyer says changed the way generations have looked at Western art. Dyer's also edited Berger's essays, which he says contain masterpieces of the form.
Back in the early 1980s, when I was writing my book about John Berger, I visited him and I saw these box folders with labels on them, things like Notes for G or G First Version. This is, of course, the 1972 Booker Prize-winning novel. And I remember thinking at the time, my God, I'd love to have a rummage around in those boxes. Now, of course, the time has passed when I might actually want to rummage in those G manuscripts myself. But, of course, it's fantastic that somebody now, as this kind of person I was then, could have a great old rummage around in the Berger archives.
I asked him if he thought that this encompassed his career. He said he didn't like that word. Ah. Then I said oeuvre, thinking maybe that sounds a bit pretentious.
No, I think that's fine, because, you know, that means work. No, I think oeuvre is a very good word. And it also connects that kind of work, that's to say putting words on paper, with other sorts of work, which is like planting trees or building houses or cooking.
But he really liked that word because he said it was about work. Mm. And that he's a working man, and that, you know, labour is a distinguished thing, and that labour is not just of the mind, but it's physical too. So do you think oeuvre is a better way of summing these boxes up?
Yeah, what does oeuvre mean? Is it French for egg or something? I should think that is why. I remember a friend of mine in France saying about Berger's incredible productivity. He said, yeah, he's gonna die in harness, that one.
Would you call him a public intellectual? And do you think that that's something that Britain sorely lacks?
John Berger is a kind of public intellectual, and one of the I think really striking things for him is his courage. He's absolutely fearless in terms of wading in and talking about stuff that's important to him with absolutely no regard at all for the harm it might do him. So we think of, for some reason, I keep going back to G. You know, 1972, he's heard he's going to get the Booker Prize and makes that really radical announcement that he's going to give half the prize money to the Black Panthers. You know, so he gets criticised by the right for giving half of it and gets criticised by the left for only giving half. I can't think of anyone else who fits the bill of a sort of public intellectual in that way. I mean, there's a lot of talk about Berger going native when he moved to the Haute Savoie. You know, he's very conscious that he's this, you know, global intellectual. And I think by living outside of the city, by removing himself to a great extent from the whole sort of literary, bitchery sort of world, this kind of thing, and by also crucially living up in the mountains like that, he felt he was getting, you know, closer to sort of some sort of big truths about the relationship between people and landscape.
Okay, I'm going to try a little bit of ambient recording now. Climbed about 5 kilometres up and stopped by a field with 3 cows. And I'm just going to point the iPhone in their direction to hear the typical sound of the cowbells echoing in the otherwise deserted, empty countryside. Certainly a beautiful spot to be grazing. Views all round of the mountains, Mont Blanc now visible in the distance, and the sun apparently triumphing over the clouds, which means I'll have to ring John and Beverly in a bit to see what the chances are for haymaking. More updates later.
Then after we've been together and looked at things and talked about things, then this lorry, which had been driven from London, kind of high security lorry, like those lorries that carry cash. what is it called? Armour Mobile Security. Yes, I think the American version. Anyway, one of these lorries like that came.
All right, you can tell it started getting serious now because the white gloves have come out, and we're just packing it into the van. So as you can see from the picture, we're just loading them into the van, moving them from the stables, and about to begin the journey back to London.
With 2 men who'd driven from London all the way to the Alps, and they went into the stable where all these boxes were that Beverly had made and that Jamie had looked at, and they put on their cellophane or protective gloves and carried them out as though they were either as though they were something contaminated or as though they were bullion and gold. All this was very strange.
Before the archive was due to arrive, Jamie had already contacted myself in the collection care department to say that the archive was coming. So I already had the background information about where it had been stored, and the fact that it had been stored in a stable sort of would alert you to the possibility that there may be things that needed checking.
Jane Pimlott is preservation coordinator at the British Library.
When Jamie arrived here in the van with the archive, it went straight into the quarantine room, and myself and colleagues in preservation actually checked that fairly closely to make sure that there was nothing alive in there and that everything was completely dry.
So what kind of condition was it in?
It was in surprisingly good condition. There were a few things that maybe had mildew or evidence of having been damp in the past, but there was no active mould, for instance. So there were only a couple of items that we actually had to isolate, really, and the rest of it was okay to go into storage.
I was lucky enough to have a sneak preview and spent a few days dipping in and out of the uncatalogued material. Reviews of John's books from all over the world in many languages were in neat folders. More interesting to me was the fact that many of the pages of the manuscripts were strips that were cut and pasted together. Much was crossed out,
but this was always done boldly, clearly and neatly. A year after the archives arrived at the library, a postgraduate student, Tom Overton, was selected to begin the first stage of cataloguing, while at the same time writing a thesis about Berger. I met him on the day he arrived to start work on the 80 boxes. Tom says you can think of the archive as if it is itself a physical work of art. He feels Berger is due for a re-evaluation, and his role as thinker and commentator about art and society in the 20th century has been under-recognised.
And it will be the first sort of full-length survey of his career that's been published since the 80s.
One of the justifications for your idea of this whole thing as a publication is the consistency of this man's thought over his lifetime.
Yeah.
He hasn't sort of deviated from his essential personality and his method of working and his political views.
I'm not quite sure about that, because that could make him sound sort of dogmatic. Obviously, there has been an essential core of being interested in the idea of human freedom, really. You know, in keeping with that, he has, I think, maintained a level of his own freedom to change his mind to a certain extent. I mean, it's not as if he's done sort of like a quite common trajectory of being, sort of, that lots of his generation have done, of being a sort of firebrand socialist in his 20s and 30s and then sort of like gone massively right-wing towards the end of it. You're right in saying that he's kept to a kind of an honest sort of core of his personality. He hasn't switched that greatly, but I think also he's been quite flexible.
Do you have any plan in your head as to how you're going to go about it? Are you going to dip in and out? Do you have some kind of strategy?
When I see it, I'll have to work out how he's done it himself. I imagine it'll run from the 50s, kind of when he left art school, up to the present, and I might start reading it in that way. You know, something that's published in the 50s might relate to something that's published 30 years later or so on and so forth. So I'd be quite interested to see how, in his drafting, if there's any difference between how he drafts a piece of criticism or how he drafts a novel, or that sort of thing. He's writing as John Berger there, or he's writing as fictional John in a novel. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
Tom might be surprised to find that the archive material John sent won't contain multiple drafts.
I mean, there are quite a lot of drafts, or stacks and stacks, which I still have, which are not in those archives. Perhaps more than many people, because, in fact, I correct what I write. I mean, I'm a very clumsy writer. Very. And I mean, most pages I write 4, 5, 6, 7 times, sometimes more. And mostly, when I'm not being a journalist, as in the past, I write by hand. So you can imagine the number of pages of drafts. And I haven't yet decided, but I mean, in a way, there's a part of me which says I think I will destroy them. Not in any sort of dramatic way, but because, you know, they've served their purpose. And the stories that they